Welcome to the East County Magazine Live Radio Show, the voice of East County, bringing you the hottest news and coolest events from the communities of San Diego's East County. We're your community radio, representing the public interest, not special interests. Broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso with your host, Miriam Raftery.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, recording at our studio in East County. Today we open with some top national news stories with far-reaching effects on people across our region. A federal court has issued a ruling that will broaden the definition of family members who are allowed to enter the U.S. despite the Trump travel ban. Then on our Capitol Report, we'll have the latest on the growing opposition to the latest health care reform bill in the Senate, including a bipartisan coalition of governors, health insurers, and patient advocacy groups. Also learn why that vote is being postponed due, ironically, to a medical emergency involving a senator whose vote could determine the outcome of the bill to repeal and replace Obamacare. We'll also have news about a landmark bill by a local member of Congress that was just passed by the House to help educators identify and help young people who are victims of sex trafficking and teach students how to avoid falling prey to traffickers. In local news, hear why the housing crisis in San Diego County is getting worse. Learn what hot items are on County Supervisors' agenda this week, including funding for body cameras, other public safety measures, and affordable housing. From Lemon Grove, hear about a judge's decision to deny a restraining order that was sought against a city council member, who now says he plans a defamation of character suit in return. Spring Valley residents are encouraged to apply to fill two vacancies on the Spring Valley Community Planning Group, and we'll have the details on today's show. On Green Scene, learn why California's Attorney General is asking the House of Representatives to block a bill that singles out the state of California by weakening our state's clean water standards. Plus, hear about the latest efforts to save national monuments in California from a Trump administration effort to shut down or sell off some cherished public lands, lands that in California are actually generating significant revenues. Now, if you've paid property taxes, gone to court, or done business with any county agency, you may be owed a refund. The county is seeking public help to find the owners of $500,000 in refunds owed to local taxpayers and businesses. We'll tell you how to find out if you're on that list on today's show. On Crime Beat, hear about efforts by the county to also find the rightful owners of over 100 items that are believed to be stolen property, found in a storage unit that belonged to an accused serial burglar. On the second half of our show today, we'll be re-airing a couple of our favorite interviews from years past, including an interview with Paula Margulis, the author of Coyote Moon, on Bookshelf. And on Sounds of History, we'll have an interview with Dick Panic from the Pacific Southwest Railway Museum on the colorful history of the railway in our region. And finally, as we enter peak fire season, we'll have some emergency preparedness tips for you and your family. So stay tuned for all of these stories on today's edition of the East County Magazine Radio Show, where East County matters.
Once again, a court has found fault with the Trump administration's travel ban. Last month, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that the Trump administration could legally prohibit people from six mostly Muslim countries from entering the U.S. But the High Court made an exception for people with close family members or other ties to the U.S., such as jobs or college, ruling that they must be allowed to enter. The Trump administration responded by crafting a very narrow definition of close family, allowing parents, children, and siblings of people in the U.S. to enter, but not most other family members. Now, federal judge Derek Watson has ruled that the Trump administration's interpretation of close family members was too narrow. The judge found that grandparents, grandchildren, brothers-in-law, sisters-in-law, aunts, uncles, nieces, nephews, and cousins of people in the U.S. should also be allowed entry. Judge Watson wrote that grandparents are the epitome of close family members. The ruling is in response filed by the state of Hawaii to the administration's policy. Countries included in the travel ban are Iran, Libya, Somalia, Sudan, Syria, and Yemen. The judge also gave protection to refugees, finding that a formal assurance from a refugee resettlement agency issued after Homeland Security has approved admission of a refugee into the U.S. is a binding contract that cannot be revoked. The Trump administration has announced that it will appeal the decision directly to the Supreme Court. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Gene Carpenter.
This is East County Magazine's Capitol Report, bringing you the latest news and newsmakers from our nation's capital. This is Miriam Raftery with a Capitol Report. The U.S. Senate has introduced a revamped bill to repeal and replace the Affordable Health Care Act with a new provision aimed at getting conservative votes. The newest version would allow insurance companies to sell skimpy, bare-bones insurance plans, provided they offer at least one plan that meets the requirements of Obamacare. So insurance companies could exclude coverage for pre-existing conditions, maternity care, drug addiction, mental health, and more, under the mantra of offering consumers a choice. The CEOs of major insurance companies, including Blue Cross, sent a joint letter to Senate leaders on Friday calling the plan unworkable in any form and warning that it will lead to widespread termination of coverage. The problem is that younger, healthier consumers would be most apt to opt for the bare-bones coverage, leaving insurance companies with more comprehensive plans footing the bill for sicker, older clients. There is also a risk to the health of young consumers who sign up for the cheapest policies not realizing what's not covered or thinking they just won't need it. An unplanned pregnancy, for instance, could leave a young couple facing tens of thousands of dollars for a normal delivery and potentially much more if there are complications during birth. A plan that excludes costly cancer treatments could be deadly for a young person who winds up with cancer early in life that needs aggressive treatment. A person may buy a cheap policy thinking they don't need addiction treatment, but if they need surgery later and get hooked on prescription painkillers, they'll be on their own to get off of them. State governors in both parties have also come out against the bill during the National Governors Association meeting, the New York Times reports. Their concerns include deep cuts to Medicaid and funding for opioid addiction, as well as eliminating protections for people with pre-existing conditions. The American Association of Retired Persons, the American Medical Association, and Advocates for Patients and the Disabled have all previously registered opposition to the measure, and the latest changes only intensify the concerns raised by those organizations. At least two Republican senators have said they will not vote for the bill. Republicans cannot lose a single additional Republican vote, since Democrats are united in their opposition. Action on the bill is being delayed a week due to Senator John McCain undergoing surgery for a blood clot behind his eye, the Associated Press reports. And ironically, this bill allows members of Congress to continue coverage under Obamacare, while weakening protections for everyone else.
The House of Representatives has passed legislation authored by San Diego Democratic Congresswoman Susan Davis to combat sex trafficking. The measure now moves to the Senate. The Empower Educators to Prevent Trafficking Act was included in a package of legislation known as the Frederick Douglass Trafficking Victims Protection Act. Davis, a senior member of the House Committee on Education and the Workplace, says, "Far too often it is our children who fall victim to the horror of human trafficking. We must do everything we can to stop this injustice." She adds, "Advocates and survivors are always telling me that it is important to punish traffickers, but we also need to focus on prevention. With the passage of this bill, our schools can join the resistance in the fight against trafficking. Armed with knowledge, students and teachers can join the battle lines against the injustice of modern-day slavery." Davis's bill would authorize grants to help school districts establish or expand programs to train school staff, including campus security, nurses, and administrators, in how to recognize signs that a student may be a victim or potential victim of sex trafficking or labor trafficking. The bill also provides options for teaching students how to avoid being victims of trafficking, as well as referring trafficked victims for legal, social, and health services. In addition, the measure establishes reporting requirements and a safety plan for employees and students when trafficking is reported to authorities. Currently, federally funded programs provide similar training to local law enforcement, social workers, child welfare officials, first responders, healthcare workers, and various other professionals who may come into contact with trafficking victims. But schools can be a prime recruiting site for sex traffickers. Experts have told Davis that teacher education is a missing piece in the coordinated efforts to stop sex trafficking. The grant program will prioritize qualified applications from school districts operating in what the Federal Bureau of Investigation has designated high-intensity child sex trafficking areas. According to the FBI, San Diego ranks among the top 13 cities in the U.S. for sex trafficking. The underground sex trafficking economy generates an estimated $810 million in annual revenues for criminals, the city of San Diego reports. Each year, there are an estimated 8,000 to 11,000 victims of sex trafficking in San Diego County. The average age of entry into sex trafficking is girls and boys who are 14 to 15 years old. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, the Network for Social Justice, this is Jean Carpenter.
The housing crisis in San Diego is getting worse. Countywide, only half the number of homes needed for our growing population are being built, and very few of those are affordable to people earning low or moderate incomes. Those are the findings of a new report by the San Diego Regional Chamber of Commerce and the Greater San Diego Association of Realtors. Their housing scorecard found that lack of affordable housing is driving seniors and families out of the state and hurting the San Diego economy. Across our region, only four small cities are building enough homes to shelter their growing populations: Coronado, Lemon Grove, San Marcos, and Vista. And some cities have not built any units at all that would be affordable to non-wealthy families. The city of San Diego is doing better than some other cities in the region, but is still building only 51% of the housing it needs. Jerry Sanders, former mayor of San Diego and current president of the San Diego Regional Chamber of Commerce, says lack of affordable housing is a frequent complaint of employers, Times of San Diego reports. Sanders adds, "For businesses in San Diego to continue to grow and create jobs, we need to make sure our workforce can afford to live here." Current San Diego Mayor Kevin Faulkner says when San Diegans leave town, the city and county lose part of the tax-paying population. He adds that high-cost housing leads to businesses taking jobs elsewhere. Faulkner said San Diego will promote policies that encourage middle-class housing and smart urban planning, but didn't specify exactly what those are. Bob Cavane, president of the Realtors Association, blames government fees and environmental regulations as contributing to the affordable housing problem. He also proposed making a home's property tax base portable at any age to allow older people to move without facing much larger tax bills. High housing costs also contribute to our region's high homeless rate. A recent study by the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development found San Diego has the fourth highest homeless rate in the nation. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, the Network for Social Justice, this is Miriam Raftery.
This is Gene Carpenter with a local government report from East County Magazine. The San Diego County Board of Supervisors meets this Tuesday and Wednesday, July 18th and 19th. Their agendas include funding for numerous public safety projects, affordable housing, construction, and more. On Tuesday, supervisors will consider funding body cameras for sheriff's deputies. Also on the agenda are proposals to expand juvenile probation activities, address mental health needs of offenders, and fund treatment for juveniles in custody who have post-traumatic stress. In addition, the Tuesday agenda includes a public hearing on issuance of $5.5 million in revenue bonds to benefit Habitat for Humanity, which builds housing for low-income people. On Wednesday, supervisors will consider an increased assessment for street lighting and landscaping maintenance in Rancho San Diego and continuation of assessment at the same rate for the Jess Martin Park area in Julian. Supervisors will consider traffic committee recommendations, including weighing a time limit for parking on Alpine Boulevard east of West Victory Drive in Alpine. In addition, the board will vote on whether to approve a final map, easements, and improvements for the proposed McCandless project in Ramona, which would include five single-family homes. You can find full agendas at the San Diego County Board of Supervisors website.
This is Miriam Raftery with a report from Lemon Grove. A judge has denied a permanent restraining order sought against Lemon Grove Councilman David Arambula by a local lawyer for whom he once worked as a paralegal. The judge found no evidentiary basis for the civil harassment order that was sought. The restraining order request was denied with prejudice, meaning it cannot be refiled. Attorney Dorinna Hirsch's request for the restraining order claimed that after she told Arambula to improve his work, he tampered with legal documents, threatened to ruin her business, and stole money, 10 News reported. In her petition, Hirsch claimed she felt terrified by what she described as threats to intimidate her out of filing criminal charges. But in an email to East County Magazine after the hearing, Arambula wrote that in his view, the petitioner's true motive for seeking the civil harassment order was to, quote, smear my name and reputation, unquote. He said he had advised Hirsch that she owed him money shortly before she filed the harassment order, which he believes was a frivolous attempt to dissuade him from filing a civil action seeking payment. Councilman Arambula added that he now plans to pursue legal action against Hirsch and possibly her lawyer for defamation of character and malicious prosecution.
This is KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso in the heart of San Diego's East County.
This is Miriam Raftery with a public service announcement from the County of San Diego. The Spring Valley Community Planning Group has two vacancies to fill due to retirement of a longtime member and a second member who is no longer able to attend meetings due to family commitments. Planning group members provide a critical service to the community by giving vital input to the county on development and other activities within the group's boundaries. To make sure that community members' voices are heard, please consider serving if you live in the Spring Valley area, the chair asks. To be eligible to fill these positions, applicants must be 18 or over and live in the Spring Valley planning area, as well as be registered to vote there. Candidates must complete an application and disclose any financial interest in real estate or businesses in Spring Valley. You should also be available to attend the planning group's meetings on the second and fourth Tuesday each month. County supervisors will make the appointments to fill these vacancies based on recommendations of the planning group, which will review all applications at a future meeting. For more information or to receive an application, you can call the Spring Valley Community Planning Group Chair, Laura Lowes, at 619-461-7243.
Now it's time for the Green Scene Report, highlighting energy, environmental, and sustainability issues in our community.
This is Gene Carpenter with the Green Scene Report. California Attorney General Javier Becerra is calling on the U.S. House of Representatives to oppose legislation that would force California to accept water quality standards that are over 22 years old and give up all enforcement of its own higher state standards. The so-called Gaining Responsibility on Water Act, or H.R. 23, would forbid only California from regulating the waters within its own borders. Becerra says, "We have worked hard as a state to protect our rivers, lakes, and waterways. They are important parts of our economic development and what makes California a great place to live, work, and raise a family. Why should we have to accept water quality standards that are over two decades old?" he asked, adding, "Why is California being singled out when our leadership on the environment is well known and has even been acknowledged by EPA Administrator Scott Pruitt? I hope my former colleagues see right through this extraordinarily flawed legislation and vote against it. That California is being singled out directly conflicts with historic principles of Western water law. In California versus United States, the U.S. Supreme Court affirmed California's rights to enforce state laws and conditions on federal reclamation projects. The High Court declared that the history of the relationship between the federal government and the states in the reclamation of the arid lands of the Western states is both long and involved, but through it runs the consistent thread of purposeful and continued deference to state water law by Congress. The bill in Congress would also require state agencies, such as the Department of Water Resources, the State Water Resources Control Board, and the Department of Fish and Wildlife, to implement federal policies in violation of state sovereignty principles set forth in the 10th Amendment and other provisions of the U.S. Constitution. The action is the latest by Attorney General Becerra to ensure ensure that California remains a leader on environmental issues. Within the last 2 weeks alone, he has challenged the Trump administration for unlawfully delaying the waste prevention rule, which requires oil and natural gas producers to significantly cut wasteful leakage of methane on federal lands, and has taken action against the EPA due to its failure to reduce methane emissions from existing oil and natural gas operations, as is required under federal law.
The National Park System in California draws 42 million visitors a year who spend more than $2 billion and support almost 30,000 jobs. Public lands advocates hope these figures, just released by the Joint Economic Committee in Congress, will convince the U.S. Interior Secretary to leave the state's national monuments intact. The agency is reviewing 27 national monuments, including 6 in California, with an eye to protecting the smallest key areas, which could open up the rest to development. Paul Smith is co-owner of the 29 Palms Inn near Mojave Trails National Monument.
What people value in the deserts out here are, number one, scenic vistas uninterrupted by man-made objects. And without this status, this land is very subjected to windmills, solar fields, and the mining industry.
In a recent letter to the Interior Secretary, a dozen Western Republican members of Congress complained that the various monuments hurt ranching, timber, energy, ATV, and mining interests. They recommended completely withdrawing monument designations for the Berryessa Snow Mountain and Cascade Siskiyou National Monuments, as well as shrinking boundaries at Giant Sequoia, San Gabriel Mountains, Mojave Trails, and Carrizo Plain National Monuments. Pete Spurr with Joshua Tree Realty, also near Mojave Trails, says he's disappointed that his congressman, Paul Cook, signed the letter.
Open space and quality public lands are beneficial to families, visitors, and businesses alike. I think it brings economic windfall to an area to be adjacent to any of these protected lands. The visitor economy is so much more robust than the mining industry.
Millions of people submitted public comments about the monuments, and the comment period ended Monday. The vast majority supports keeping them intact. Interior Secretary Ryan Zinke's final report is due on August 24th. Conservation groups have already vowed to sue if the administration tries to rescind any monument designations. For Public News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
The County of San Diego is looking for more than 1,300 residents and businesses who have unclaimed property tax refunds, Superior Court money, or funds due them from other county departments. Over $500,000 remain unclaimed. County Treasurer and Tax Collector Dan McAllister says the county has been trying to reach people owed refunds for 2 years or more. For some, the deadline to claim that money is September 8th. For others, the time frame is longer, depending on how long ago that refund was issued. After the deadline passes, the money will be turned over to the county's general fund, as is required by law. The amounts of refunds range from as low as $10 to as high as $60,000 to Balcor, with many amounts over $1,000. Now, I checked that list, and I found the Anza Borrego Desert Foundation, as well as one of my doctors, on the list, and I notified them both that they're due a refund, so it's a good idea to check for your friends and acquaintances, too. In the past 5 years, McAllister's office has refunded nearly $400,000 in overpaid taxes and fees, but the majority of the funds were never claimed. And so, he says, we are asking the public's help to spread the word so we can get this money back to its rightful owner. You can find the list of unclaimed refunds at the San Diego County Treasurer and Tax Collector site, or visit our website at eastcountymagazine.org and click the News section. If you think you may be owed money, you can also call toll-free at 877-829-4732 for assistance. This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ.
This is East County Magazine's Crime Beat. On the streets, reporting on crimes impacting communities across our region, helping to keep you safe and informed.
The San Diego District Attorney's Office is looking for the owners of hundreds of items that have been impounded by law enforcement in connection to a burglary series throughout San Diego County. A treasure trove of items was found in a storage unit belonging to a serial burglary suspect. Photos of all the items can be found on the DA's Facebook page. They include jewelry, artwork, stamp collections, photographs, keys, and much more. If you recognize any of the more than 100 items, please contact the DA so that you can be reunited with your property and the suspected thief held accountable. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Gene Carpenter.
This is KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, bringing you public interest news from our region.
The East County Magazine show on KNSJ Radio is produced by the nonprofit Heartland Coalition. We're your community news. We reflect your interest, not special interest. You can get involved by volunteering, get trained to be a citizen journalist, and support East County Magazine at www.eastcountymagazine.org. And you can send your news tips and story ideas to editor@eastcountymagazine.org. Now stay tuned for part two of the East County Magazine radio show.
Welcome to Bookshelf, bringing you stories of local literary luminaries and some great books to read. My name is Raina Menashe, and I'll be your host for this segment. Today I'm speaking with Paula Margulies, award-winning author of the historical novel Favorite Daughter, Part 1. She's also written the novel Coyote Heart and a short story collection called Face Value, Collected Stories. My guest is also a contributor to Author Magazine, the San Diego Examiner, and the Writer's Edge. She owns and runs Paula Margulies Communications, a public relations firm for authors and artists. Welcome, Paula. It's a pleasure having you on Bookshelf.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
Let's begin with your new novel, Favorite Daughter, Part 1. This is the Pocahontas story, but it's told from her perspective. What prompted you to tell such a well-known and iconic story from the Native American point of view, instead of from John Smith's?
Well, you know, I wrote my first novel, which was set here in San Diego, a contemporary novel, and it was called Coyote Heart, and it was set on the Pala Indian Reservation. So it had a Native American story to it, a theme to it. Mm-hmm. And finished that novel and decided, you know, I was going to write a sequel to it or something similar. And at that time, I happened to read a book by Sina Jeter Naslin, a historical novel called Abundance, which was about Marie Antoinette, the life of Marie Antoinette. And she told the story from her point of view, rather than the traditional history
right.
we've heard about the French Revolution and let them eat cake and all of that.
Right.
She let Marie Antoinette tell her version of what happened. And she was 14 years old when she was first brought to France to marry this king. And it was fascinating. And just to hear that first person voice and get that
sure.
female perspective on history, I thought, oh, I want to do that.
Uh-huh.
So I thought, okay, who would I write about? And I've always been interested in Pocahontas. I grew up here in California where we learned, California history in fourth grade when we visited the missions and all of that. So I didn't really know the Pocahontas story. And when I started to read her story, I read both the John Smith version of history, some of his writing, some of the historians that were out there, Massacre and Helen Roundtree. And then I came across some Native American tellings of her story. And the one that was most interesting to me was written by Dr. Linwood Costello, who's a Mattaponi Indian, and with the help of Angela Daniel, who is also Mattaponi. And their version of her story was, he claimed, handed down through oral tradition, 400 years of oral tradition. And his version was very different than the John Smith version. And I thought, oh, here's the story I'd like to tell. And I'd like to let her tell it just
right.
the way Naslin did in her book. So that's how the whole thing came about.
So it's really like uncovering the real story.
Yeah.
And I know that it's this one, the story of Pocahontas, from her point of view, that it's darker than the version that we're familiar with. Tell us about that. How did your research lead you to this darker version? And why do you think it Why do you think it hasn't made its way into popular storytelling until now?
That's a great question. You know, I think so much of history has a male perspective. I think in this case, John Smith wrote quite a bit about his time in the colonies, and that's because the Virginia Company of London had hired him to come to the new land and find, you know, this, you know, gold and whatever other natural resources they were looking for. And so a lot of his writing was, I think his purpose was to make himself look good and to make the colonists right. look good and to make the venture look successful. So the focus was more, I think, on that perspective. And I think the natives that they met along the way were incorporated into his version of the story in order to show him in a good light. Well, when you read the native version of the story, according to Dr. Costello, it's much darker. Gosh, when she first met John Smith, she was 11 years old. She was a young girl. So the romanticized version of the relationship between her and Smith, he was 27 when he came in 1607 to the colony. Yeah, so there's a huge age gap there. I, in my imagination and from what I've read in history, I think they were very good friends. I think they were fascinated with each other, mm-hmm. but she was a very young girl. And so, according to Costello, there never was that romantic relationship, but there was a political reason for her to be involved in that her father saw that she had this, you know, kind of friendship with Smith, and he kind of used that. In fact, she was kind of used by all the men in her life, mm-hmm. and that's a lot of the story,
yeah.
is kind of the betrayal and just the way she figured in the history. But according to Costello, it was very dark. She was abducted, which is a known fact in history, after she married Kokoam, and there is dispute over whether he even existed. But for those historians who say she was married to this native, Kokoam, she lived in his village, and his uncle was the chief of the tribe, and the uncle conspired with the colonists for the abduction. They were the ones who actually lured her onboard ship, and her father did not rescue her. I mean, they kind of held her for ransom, and he said, no, I'm not going to do it. And I think that broke her heart in a lot of ways. And so according to Dr. Costello, when she converted to Christianity, this was coerced. She was held there against her will. According to him, she was raped by the governor of the colony at the time, Thomas Gates. And in fact, he claims that the marriage to John Rolfe, she later married a colonist, that marriage was coerced, and that the child that she had with Rolfe was actually from the rape. And that's what the child's name is, Thomas. So according to the oral wow. tradition,
yeah.
this all happened. And at the end of her story, she eventually, you know, married John Rolfe and became kind of a figurehead in England, very well known as kind of a celebrity, and they mm-hmm. brought her over later to England. She met the king and queen, and she later connected with John Smith, who had left in 1609. He burned his thigh in a gunshot incident. I don't know if gunpowder went off in a boat or something. Mm-hmm. He burned himself. He decided he had to go back to England to take care of that, and he never came back. And she was devastated by that. In fact, when she went to Jamestown right after he left and said, where is he? They told her that he had died. So when she eventually was brought to England, she ran into him, and a lot of historians have documented this. So they did meet, and she's very angry with him when she met him. But on the way home from that voyage, the traditional history is that she developed a case of pneumonia and she died. She's 21 years old. She only lived for 10 years. But the Mattapony Indians, Dr. Costello, in his version, he claims that she was murdered, that she was poisoned. And so it's just a different kind
amazing.
Of perspective on the whole thing
right.
and how, you know, what her life was really like.
And it really makes us look at, you know, when we judge history by the story that we're handed, we don't always see it from the perspective of the details of the person involved. If she was 11 years old and she was exploited, it puts a whole different light on everything.
It does. It does. And she was an amazing person. I mean, I imagine her as someone who was fascinated with these foreigners, who was fascinated with the idea of another world,
sure.
who wanted to see that world. Also, she's very astute. She was good at the language, at learning the English language. And, I think her father saw that in her. And that's mm-hmm. why she kind of became a conduit between the colonists and the tribes. Sure. And so she played an amazing role in history. At the same time, she was kind of used.
Right.
And so it's kind of interesting just to see that native perspective. Yeah.
A gifted, curious young woman.
Yeah, yeah.
Or a young girl, I should say, in the beginning. How about you? Are you Native American heritage?
I am not. I'm full-blooded Italian, both sides. Although my father was always interested in Native history and Native artifacts, so I kind of grew up with, you know, a respect for Native culture and traditions and music and art. And he was very much into that. He passed away a year ago, and so that was something we always – I grew up with that. So I've always had that interest.
So you've crossed cultures as well.
A little bit, yeah, a little bit.
Now – let's go back to Pocahontas. She's from this native world where strangers appear in the shore of her village. When you were doing your research and you were learning about that lost world, can you share with us any details that really struck with you that you hadn't heard about previously that you think are the most telling of what life was like back then?
That's a good question. You know, as I imagine it, at the time when John Smith and the colonists first appeared in the New World, the Native American tribes there had encountered the Spaniards. They've already been visited by other European cultures, and those were not good encounters. And I think my sense from the history and what I've read is that they could tell that they were facing change, that these people that were coming now more often and more, that was one of their concerns when John Smith landed. Are there more? Are you going to live here? Are you, you know, what are you doing here? And as the supply vessels kept coming, they realized that these people are not going to go away. And there was some dispute among the tribe as to what to do. Powhatan, Chief Powhatan was friendly. He was curious about them, willing to trust them, but his interest was to have them help him fight the Spaniards if they ever return. His brother, Obachankano, also a chief, was not open to having them there and didn't want any kind of relationship with them. So there was a lot of, I think within the tribe, a lot of division and kind of disagreement over what to do. So I think it brought in a time of, it was tumultuous and kind of frightening and it kind of sad because I think some of the natives there realized as more and more of the colonists arrived that their culture was going to change. And so it was a time of big change.
They saw the end coming, really.
They started to. Yeah, they started to. It was hard to accept, you know, and I think that led to a lot of mistakes in terms of the relationship and how they negotiated for themselves. And,
right.
Yeah, so it was interesting. And the world itself was, it was interesting writing this book because when I wrote my first book, that was a contemporary novel, which was so easy to write in comparison to this historical because here in modern day, you can get in the car and go anywhere. You can take a plane. You can ride a bus. You can be in another country in a day. Back then, everything all the travel was on foot or by canoe, and that was it. So in writing that story, I realized how focused they were on the area they lived in and how much the natural world mattered to them because of that. This was the world they knew. And so setting a scene, you know, trying to transition scenes or make scenes appear in different places was tough because they didn't go anywhere. Yeah, this 11-year-old girl was heavily guarded. If she did go to Jamestown, in my book she does, a lot of people went with her. It was a full day journey on foot. You know, that was the kind of thing you had to deal with. So in the setting itself was kind of limiting in some way, writing the historical. So the challenge was to try and make different scenes happen in different areas within the village or within the forested area around them or within near Jamestown or on these rivers. But that's kind of the location issue you're dealing with in a historical. So it's different. You kind of very focused in on the landscape and the natural world, which is so important to the culture. So there's kind of a sadness in a sense, too, to see that, you know, the colonists came looking for natural resources. So there was a lot of exploitation in that sense, too. So it's kind of a sad time, time of change.
And when you were writing the book, to immerse yourself in the mood of all that world, did you listen to music? Did you?
Oh, I burn incense when I write. It's always been my, as soon as I light that incense and I smell it, it's time to settle down and write.
It brings you back.
So, but I've always felt it's really important to have sensory detail in the writing, touches and smells and all of that. So you kind of have to imagine the setting because we're not on the East Coast here, and then write that into the story. And I think if you know your character well, you can kind of see it through her eyes and sense that world. And if you really immerse yourself in it and let her speak through you, you kind of, you have access to all of that.
Great point. Well, I know that in addition to writing and researching, you also market and promote other authors. What would you like to tell all those writers out there who envision a story and dream of making it come to life? Is it the sensory details, doing your research? Any advice for the writers out there?
I think the most important element of writing a story like this, or any story, is to really feel your characters, to immerse yourself in your characters, especially your main character. I think you have to know what she wants, what she longs for, what her dreams are, what her fears or hopes, her, what she loves, what she hates. You have to have a deep, deep sense of who she is to write her story, especially if you're telling it in first person, you know, from a perspective of history. You have to have that. If you don't have that, I think you'd be lost. So I think that's the most important thing, is to really feel the character, immerse yourself in character. And then those sensory details, to me personally, I just find that to be the most excruciatingly hard and important part of writing, because I think you have to put the reader in the scene and have the reader see what she's seeing and what she's feeling and what she can touch and smell and hear. So yes, those sensory details are all part of it. And if it's happened in the past, or if it's in an area you don't know well, you have to research that area. If there are, you know, if there's nature involved or elements involved, you have to know the timing for those and what animals are in those areas, and you have to understand all of that too. So
do your homework.
Getting the sensory detail down and doing the homework, but mostly immersing yourself in the character. So after a while, you hear her voice in your head and she speaks. I mean, you start to feel like you're channeling that person, and she's writing her story, and then it's true. I think then at that point, the character takes over and the writer just gets out of the way, kind of.
Wonderful. One last question, Paula.
Yes.
What book is next, and when can we expect to see it?
Well, as you know, this is part one of her story. So this book focuses mainly on John Smith's arrival in the colony and some of the coming of age experiences that she has as an 11-year-old girl who's maturing, who's betrothed to be married, who's the daughter of a chief. So all of those events in her life are kind of captured in part one. Part two, the story picks up after John Smith leaves. She marries Kokoam. She's abducted, and then that part of the story happens next. So I'm writing part two right now, and it's going to take a couple of years, I think, to get that written and polished up. And then I have an idea for another novel later on. That one will be set in Hawaii. It takes place in Molokai in the time of Father Damien. So that's kind of cooking in the back burner right now. But I'm focused on part two right now of this story.
And I know you have some events coming up.
I do. Yeah. November is National Native American Heritage Month. So I've been asked to speak at 5 of the local libraries here in San Diego.
Great.
The first appearance will be on November 8th at the Community University Branch Library at 12:30. And the following Saturday, the 15th, I'll be at the Pacific Beach Taylor Branch Library at 12:30. The following Tuesday, November 18th, I'll be at the Claremont Branch Library at 6:30 p.m., so that'll be an evening talk. And then the last day of appearances is November 22nd, and I'll be at 2 libraries that day. In the morning, at 12 o'clock noon, I'll be at the Rancho Penasquitos Branch Library, and then at 2 o'clock, I'll be appearing at the Oceanside Branch Library. And at that event, there will be powwow drummers from 1 to 2 p.m., and then I'll speak from 2 to 3, and then the library is offered to have some food trucks, some Native food brought in, so that will be a whole Native American event.
It sounds like fun.
Yeah, highlighting the month, so that'll be the final kickoff on the 22nd.
Well, Paula, our time is up, but thank you so much for joining us and telling us about your book.
Thank you for having me.
For more information on Paula Margulies, her work, and her blog, please visit her website at paulamargulies.com, and that's spelled P-A-U-L-A-M-A-R-G-U-L-I-E-S. GULIES. Again, this is Raina Menashe, and you have been listening to East County Magazine's Bookshelf, bringing you stories of local literary luminaries and some great books to read.
You're listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, broadcasting from the desert to the sea.
This is Helen Ofield from the Lemon Grove Historical Society, bringing you the sounds of history. Today, we are resuming our conversation with Richard Pennock, the former president and CEO, founding member, and now the media coordinator of the Pacific Southwest Railway Museum Association. Dick Pennock, welcome back to the program.
Yeah, good morning, Helen. I'm glad to be here again with you. It's certainly my pleasure.
Last time, we learned about the size and operations of the Railway Museum. Our listeners can actually Google Pacific Southwest Railway, some variation of those words, and find you. But what's the main phone number?
The main phone number is area code 619-465-PSRM. That's 7776 on the dial.
I'm going to repeat that. It's 619-465-7776. Gosh, that's patriotic.
It is.
Sounds like the American Revolution. And it sounds like it was all the way out in Campo. You really have written the book on how to restore old trains and make them accessible to the public. Now, perhaps your most famous operation is that living history component, those weekend train rides at Campo. You are there as a conductor and locomotive engineer in full regalia, I might add. How much is a ticket, and do you still travel from Campo to Tecate?
We have weekend-only trains. We recommend that people check our website, psrm.org, to make sure of the schedule before they make the drive out there. It is a long way from San Diego, but certainly we feel it's worth the ride. We do not currently go to Tecate, and the reason is there is a railroad tunnel just over the international border on the Mexican side that burned and collapsed Christmas Day 2009. And since that time, the tunnel has not been repaired, and our monthly trips to Tecate had to be temporarily curtailed. So currently, we confine all of our operations and our special activities to the U.S. side of the border, between the border and Campo.
Why is the Campo train ride sometimes called the Polar Express?
Well, like all nonprofits, we do need to protect our bottom line, and we have many public activities, special activities during the year. The biggest one being our Santa train in the Christmas season. The first train runs the day after Thanksgiving, and we run 12 to 15 of those on consecutive weekends through the Christmas season. It is extremely popular, sold out every year, and as a matter of fact, Helen, members can buy their tickets for it right now.
Wonderful. Parents out there, get ready. Richard, at the dawn of the railroad, nobody had a union. There were no OSHA rules, occupational safety and health. So what were some of the dangers to, say, a brakeman on the railroad or another worker?
Interesting you ask about the brakeman, because on the railroad, particularly in the early days, that was one of the most dangerous occupations in train service. Now, even then, as now, you could get a job on the railroad in the office and never have to worry about ice and snow and sleet and storm. But the brakeman's job, before the days of air brakes, required that the brakeman, and they were all men in those days, had to ride the tops of the freight cars on a freight train in all weather, and they lost many of them in service, so there was generally always a job available, a job opening for brakemen, because the turnover was pretty high. It was a very hazardous occupation. Now, the passenger brakeman had it a little easier. He rode inside the passenger coaches normally with a conductor, so that wasn't quite so bad. But the freight brakeman on the freight trains, pretty horrible job.
Now, when people were riding the rails, which is the subject of poetry and song and folk music and all of the lore of the 1930s, really, what was that like for somebody to ride the rails? Are you, where are you?
You mean like a hobo?
Yes.
Well,
In a word.
There were two different types of illegal rail riders, hobos and bums. Bums in those days had the same connotation it has today. Hobos sometimes were of a different cut. Sometimes they were riding the train illegally, but sort of looked the other way officially, because they were searching for work. They were moving from one workplace, one seasonal workplace possibly, to another, and many of the railroads often cut them a little slack and would not necessarily kick them off. They were all lumped under the term hobo, but there were differences. The bums often spent their evenings in jail when they were caught, whereas the hobos were, if you can say, maybe a somewhat higher echelon of itinerant society, shall we say.
Dick, the classic movie image is of a group of hobos. These are lonely guys in felt hats who go and offer to chop wood for a sandwich. They're all together in an empty freight car. They jump off at different points. Are we saying the wino, some poor tragic guy, is literally under that freight car? If we're riding the rails, we're so close to the rails, we're almost on them. Is that what that phrase means? It's a scary thing.
Well, not necessarily, but certainly there have been a lot of fatalities by bums, winos, others that aren't supposed to be on the property, going to sleep in a drunken stupor on a railroad track, which can be a very fatal exercise. And it happens often on the Mexican side of the border, particularly at night. It even happens on the U.S. side. It's an unfortunate part of railroad operation. There are people that don't watch the crossing signs when they're crossing railroad tracks in their car or on foot. And in spite of all the warning signs and all of the measures the railroads try to take to promote safety, there
we
are still
tragedies even now.
Still tragedies.
Exactly. Richard, you have been intimately involved with railroads for all of your life, long ago and far away, as a carefree, wind-in-your-hair young man. Didn't you ride the rails? Have you had personal experience?
I did, and I do. Even in my senior years, I continue to have experiences that I cherish very highly. I will tell you that I have never had professional railroad experience. I get asked that question a lot. But I did try to get a job with the railroad in Oakland, California, back in the mid-1950s, right after I got out of high school, because I wanted to become a fireman on a steam locomotive. And unfortunately, the railroad was getting rid of its steam locomotives at the time, and they wrote me back a Dear John letter saying, well, we're sorry, but we've laid off most of our firemen because we don't have a need for them anymore. And I always look back on those days and wonder if, should I have continued with trying to get a railroad career.
Were you hand-firing a coal-burning?
No, that was on an oil-burning locomotive. It would have been had I got the job. But I had that opportunity many years later when we founded the museum. But you asked about some other adventures that I have had over the years, and those have been many, particularly with regard to trains. And I had one, and I have to tell you up front, Helen, that this was strictly illegal. Do not encourage anybody to do this. It is strictly forbidden and against the law. But I was a young, headstrong, adventurous kid in those days, and I and others decided to hop a freight train on the railroad that we currently operate on, and we were going to take this ride through Carrizo Gorge and just have a ball. So we encamped ourselves on a flat car in a freight train, and we were coming back from El Centro in late afternoon, and there are 17 tunnels just in the 11 miles of the Carrizo Gorge section, and the first tunnel is protected by an overhead structure called a telltale. Basically, it's just a wooden framework with ropes with knots on the end of them hanging down about 3 feet below the top of this gantry. And it's designed to warn a trainman on top of a car that there's a tunnel or limited head clearance coming up. So should they be facing the wrong way, it warns them that you better duck because there's something coming up that might take the upper part of your torso off. So I was facing the wrong way when we were coming up to the first tunnel and enjoying the view and the fresh air in my hair. And all of a sudden, this telltale hit me in the back, and I immediately flattened on top of the car. And had I not done so, the tunnel was coming up in about an eighth of a mile, and I would have been a dead person. So it was
Richard, very hazardous. Thank you for sharing that. And dear listeners, this does fall under the heading of don't try this at home, unless you are the body double for Sean Connery. I think we've all seen somebody or Steve McQueen fall to the roof and suddenly there's a tunnel and the audience is aghast. Thank you so much.
You're very welcome, Helen.
Dick Penick, this has been a wonderful conversation. I want to thank you for stopping by and sharing the lore, some of the lore. There's obviously much more from the Pacific Southwest Railway Museum. We didn't even get into the archives, and I know you have a big, big archive of precious material. Thank you, listeners, for tuning into the Sounds of History. I'm Helen O'Field.
This is Miriam Raftery with East County Magazine and KNSJ bringing you some special information as we enter fire season. How prepared are you for an emergency? Just as you change your smoke detector batteries whenever you change your clocks for daylight savings time, it's also a smart idea to check your emergency kit at the start of every fire season. That means now. Of course, emergencies such as an earthquake or a blackout can happen at any time with no advance warning. For households with children, elderly people, or those with limited mobility, being ready to take action is especially important. Updating your emergency list should start with a checklist. Did you add or lose any members of your household? Be sure to have enough supplies for everyone, including people and pets. Check the dates on canned goods and other perishables, and be sure that stored drinking water is still good. Create an emergency plan for your family. Identify two places for the family to meet. One should be somewhere outside your home, but close by, perhaps a neighbor's or a street corner. The other should be a spot away from your neighborhood, just in case the entire area is evacuated and you can't return. Using information from SDG&E and supplementing it with some additional tips, we've come up with the following helpful suggestions to be prepared. Practice an evacuation plan with your family, including children. If they get used to doing something when there is no panic, they will be much less frantic should a real disaster strike. Review emergency plans at your workplace, your child's school or daycare center, friends' homes, and other places where members of your family regularly spend time. Plan safe routes away from your home and business to high, safe ground, and be sure all family members know the routes. Have alternative routes in mind if the first option is blocked. Develop a plan for family pets and livestock, and have a backup plan because some evacuation shelters may not allow animals. Designate a friend or family member outside the area who all family members can call if you become separated, and that way you can know if everyone is safe. Have family members memorize that phone number in case cell phones die and you can't access the phone directory. Keep current important documents in a safe deposit box or send copies outside the area to be kept by a trusted relative or friend. Be sure that you can access your insurance policy and have a copy of your deed, for example. After Hurricane Katrina, when banks were destroyed by flooding and hurricanes, many homeowners had a lot of trouble putting in their insurance claims. Have a set place for your emergency supplies. Your emergency kit should include, at minimum, a 3-day supply of bottled water, 1 gallon per person per day, plus extra for pets or anyone with special needs. A 3-day supply of packaged, dried, and canned food that can be prepared without cooking. A first aid kit and essential medicines for all family members. A pet carrier for each pet and pet food. A manual can opener. A portable radio, plenty of batteries, and flashlights kept in waterproof bags. An extra set of car keys. Credit cards. And always plenty of cash in case the power is out when ATM machines and credit card machines are not working. Special items for infants, elderly, or disabled family members. It's also important to make sure that you always keep plenty of gas in your car since pumps won't work when the power goes out. Also be sure you have a car charger for your cell phones since during a power outage, you don't want your cell phone to go dead. Car chargers are cheap, often less than $10, but can be crucial in an emergency. Know how to operate everything if the electricity is off. The keyless entry to your home, and an electric garage door and gates, for instance. Be sure you know how to open them manually. If you have a gas main, know how to shut it off in case of a leak or a disaster. Include instructions on how to shut off anything that's complicated in your family emergency kit. It's better to have supplies ready and never need them than to need them and not have them. SDG&E has also prepared some videos on fire season planning and general emergency preparedness that can be accessed in the Wildfire and Emergency section of our website at www.eastcountymagazine.org. This concludes today's episode of East County Magazine's radio show. We extend our appreciation to the Heartland Coalition, our parent nonprofit, and to KNSJ 89.1 FM, broadcasting from the heart of East County and Descanso. We extend our appreciation to our sound technician, Liz Alper, and to our producer, Miriam Raftery. We also thank the musicians who provided music for our show, Laura Preble, Jim Hannibal, Corey Clement, Giovanni Galicia and the Smashing Beats, Donnie Gentile, Wooden Ambulance, Dusty Summer Road, A.K. Jules, Brian Boykel, Royalty Free Music, Frank Nora, Kevin McLeod, April's Dance from the Smart Sound Solo Simplicity Collection, Turco, Nomads of the Silk Road, Blues 3 Music, and Pond 5. If you have story ideas or would like to underwrite the East County Magazine radio show, please contact editor@eastcountymagazine.org or call 619-698-7617. We'll be back soon for another edition of East County Magazine's radio show.